How about a little pop quiz? What scientific event in the past decade inspired country songs, state legislature resolutions, parades, and thousands of angry letters from third graders across the nation? The answer has to do with a small, round, icy body 5.9 billion miles from the sun, Pluto. When astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson was hired as the director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History, he designed the new planet exhibit without Pluto, and that set off a controversy of cosmic proportions. His latest book, The Pluto Files, tells the story of Pluto from its discovery to its demotion to dwarf planet. It's recently been issued in a paperback edition by Norton. I'm delighted that it brings Neil deGrasse Tyson back to our show today. Hello.
Happy to be back with you. Thanks for having me.
You wrote that you were hired by the American Museum of Natural History in 1995 to revitalize the Hayden Planetarium. What was lacking at the time?
Well, at the time, there was the previous building, and planetarium architecture of that era, this was basically 1930s, was conceived as a housing for the then very new and modern optical projector, the Zeiss optical projector. It was a design without precedent. Previous planetarium concepts were like basically holes in an illuminated backlit dome, and you'd have to rotate the whole dome in order to change your view of the night sky. So this was a remarkable bit of technology, justifying an entire architecture to surround it. And so the facility was not really designed to house exhibitry on the rest of the universe. You would come in, there'd be some posters on the wall, you'd wait in line for the show to begin, and then you would leave. The new facility was designed to completely capture all of the exciting frontiers that were active in astrophysics.
When you designed the exhibit, did you expect to create such a firestorm?
No. We read the writing on the wall, and part of that writing on the wall was Pluto was being already rethought in the textbooks. Previously, you might have a different chapter on each planet enumerating their properties and describing them. And over time, basically into the 70s, people started, educators, scientists, started grouping Pluto with other odd objects in the solar system, odd compared with the traditional large round planets. So with comets and asteroids. So there's some chapters that say Pluto, comets, asteroids, and other vagabonds, for example. That was one of the first sort of chisels in Pluto's armor.
As I mentioned, you got a lot of letters from school children who insisted that Pluto was a planet. Do you think they would have done the same if you dwarfed Mercury,
no,
which is kind of small?
I don't think people care. Mercury is also small. They would care if it happened to Earth, I think.
So why Pluto?
Well, I scratched my head for the longest time on that very question. By the way, school children didn't send in hate mail until our decision at the Rose Center for Earth and Space, the rebuilt Hayden Planetarium, mysteriously, from my read, ended up as a page one story of the New York Times with the headline, Pluto Not a Planet? Only in New York. And that was a full year after we opened the exhibit. I had fully expected that after 12 months, no one was going to make a big stink about it, and we'd go on with this new understanding, with Pluto grouped with other icy bodies recently discovered in the outer solar system.
Do you think it's because Pluto was added to the planetary group during some people's lifetimes?
That's a good point. And yes, that's true for many. If you're born before 1930, Pluto was discovered in your lifetime. And Pluto was also discovered by an American. And so you might think that these two factors would weigh heavily in the hearts and minds of Americans. But a quick poll demonstrates that that couldn't be the case. No more than 1 out of 10 Americans even knew that an American discovered it. So after long soul searching on this, I had to land on the fact that there's a dog that's fuzzy, cuddly.
See, it's Disney. It's not the Roman god of the dead.
Totally
that it was named
not.
After.
It is so not the Roman god of the underworld. It is a fuzzy, cuddly dog. And in our efforts to, we're actually creating a documentary based on the book, should air in March on PBS, PBS Nova. In that effort, we went around interviewing some people who think long and hard about Disney's role in our culture, including sort of Roy Disney, the grandnephew himself. And he concluded, once I shared with him sort of my side of what's going on, it's got to be, there aren't many cosmic objects where there are warm, fuzzy associations with their names. And so you got a Pluto, a cosmic object with a fuzzy, cuddly dog, you're stuck.
Well, maybe they should do a different kind of exhibit at Disneyland.
Well, Disney has a fascinating history on the frontier of space exploration. Those who were around and sort of sentient in the 1950s may remember that Disney's Tomorrowland was basically inspired by the effort to try to get people thinking about a future in space.
But it is interesting that Pluto, which is, he is the god of the dead, and we have that word plutocracy, which is also negative connotations, that that would be totally thrown out the window, and all we'd be thinking about is Mickey Mouse's dog.
Yeah, since when does sort of literacy matter in people's feelings? It never mattered. Words mean whatever people want them to mean. Dictionaries are quite secondary and tertiary in these matters.
Where does plutocracy come from, do you know?
I don't know for sure. Plutocracy, if I remember the definition, is sort of ruling by the rich and the powerful mm-hmm. rather than by an elected set. And since Disney's kind of in charge of this, that you can call that a plutocracy, if you'd like.
You've said that Pluto was an oddball from the beginning.
Well, not from the very beginning. At the very beginning, people just assumed, because they were in search of Planet X, based on what were believed to be perturbations to the orbital path of Neptune, you either throw away Newton's laws because they're not correctly predicting where Neptune is going in the solar system, or you hypothesize that there's some yet-to-be-discovered object in the outer solar system whose gravity is torquing Neptune. And so you keep Newton's laws, at least for the moment, and you go looking for a Planet X. And that's what it went on for decades. And Percival Lowell launched a Planet X at the Lowell Observatory. He's rich enough to just name it after himself because he built it. The Lowell Observatory in Arizona. And later on, Clyde Tombaugh, a farm boy from Illinois, would be hired and finish out that study long after Lowell died. And he found Pluto.
And was Pluto doing that to Neptune?
Well, it was assumed it was until people got a closer look at Pluto and found it's not as big as they thought it was. They thought it should be as big as Neptune. The earliest listings of Pluto's properties identified as something commensurate with the size of Neptune based on expectation, not based on any real kind of measurement. And over time, the size and the mass of Pluto, as measurements got more and more accurate, went down and down and down. It was clear that was not Planet X that anybody was looking for.
Is there an official definition of a planet?
There was not. The only time before 2006, the only time the word planet had been defined was ancient Greece, where you look up against the night sky and you see stars, and then, hey, wait a minute, some things are moving night to night against those background stars. There were seven of them. The word for wanderer in Greek is planetes, wanderers, and that's where we get the word planet from.
But planets do fit into two distinctive groups, don't they?
Well,
and Pluto doesn't fit into either of those.
Wait, let's back up. In ancient Greece, the only group you had to fit into was did you move against the background sky? Mm-hmm. And there were seven planets, Mercury, Venus, Mars. Earth wasn't a planet because we're not in our own sky. Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, the Sun, and the Moon. And we trace through Norse and Roman legends the names of the 7 days of the week to those seven planetary objects. And so only after Copernicus, where he said, wait a minute, guys, maybe the sun is in the middle and Earth goes around the sun and the moon goes around Earth. And so then what did planet mean anymore? Are we the same as the sun? No, it can't be. And so we kind of grandfathered in some understanding that Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn would be planets. And that notion didn't have to be rethought, because it was simple and easy. And only when we started learning more and more about the solar system, the nuances of orbits, the fact that there's a whole swath of real estate discovered in 1800, not previously known, that later known as the asteroid belt. In the 1990s, we discovered another swath of real estate that Pluto is a part of, the Kuiper belt of icy bodies beyond Neptune. So as our vocabulary becomes more and more in need of nuance, the word planet begins to lose more and more of what its definition would be.
Well, while the eight planets that we all agree upon orbit the sun in a horizontal plane, Pluto's orbit is on a 30-degree angle relative to the rest.
Well, not quite 30. If I say about 17 or 18 degrees tipped. So but that's twice as much as the next most tipped planet, which would be Mercury in this case. So Pluto, practically every measurable thing about Pluto is different from those other eight. And here's the catch. So what if you're different? I mean, we live in a society here in America where we embrace differences and bring them into the fold. The difference here is that we, in the 1990s, discovered other icy bodies in the outer solar system beyond Neptune with properties similar to Pluto. So no longer did we have to say, okay, Pluto, we'll take you even though you're different. We say, Pluto, you now have brethren in the outer solar system.
So are we now saying that Pluto is an asteroid, or are we calling it a dwarf planet?
Well, in 2006, the international community voted in a triennial conference in Prague, and the vote took Pluto, reclassified it as a dwarf planet, and added some new criteria for what a planet would and should be. And that got a lot of people angry who were big Pluto fans. I didn't have a horse in that race, believe it or not. I was just happy to group Pluto with its friends and group other like objects with their friends.
Are there bigger ones than Pluto orbiting around the sun?
When the first other icy object in the outer solar system was discovered, much smaller than Pluto, it became clear to people that if we kept looking, we'd ultimately find ones bigger. And in fact, yes, there are bigger objects beyond Neptune orbiting the sun with weird orbits, icy just like Pluto.
My guest is Neil deGrasse Tyson, whose book, The Pluto Files, has just been issued in paperback by Norton. A probe to Pluto was launched in 2006. Was that the first one?
Yes, first time anyone's ever went to Pluto. And one of Pluto's biggest proponents, Alan Stern, is the principal investigator of that mission. And I count him as a good friend and colleague, in spite of perceived deep differences in our outlook on what's going on in the outer solar system. He's head of a very important mission because no one's ever been beyond Neptune with the intent of studying objects that orbit the sun.
And what did NASA learn?
We're
not there yet. I know.
Can't be that impatient when you're going to the outer solar system. It's the fastest hunk of hardware ever launched from Cape Canaveral. And it's a really huge rocket with a relatively small payload, and that combination gets you very fast. We went past the moon in just a few hours, for example. And with a
where is it now?
I don't have the very latest, but it should arrive in the Pluto zone in the year 2015. And so one of the most important rules in science and science experiments is you want to make sure you get a result before you die. So whatever is your planning for that experiment, make sure you're still alive and perky by the time it gets there.
So that's why we haven't sent a probe to Alpha Centauri.
Yeah, that one, that'd be a tough one. So that's why we have telescopes. You get a close-up view with just your telescope.
We have to take a little break. We'll be back with more Neil deGrasse Tyson right after this. We're back with Neil deGrasse Tyson of the Hayden Planetarium and the American Museum of Natural History. His latest book, The Pluto Files, The Rise and Fall of America's Favorite Planet, has just been issued in a paperback edition by Norton. And in the book, you include resolutions passed by the state legislatures of New Mexico and California to keep Pluto a planet within those states. Can you do that?
Yeah, that's the most hilarious part of this entire saga. I mean, it's been going on since, at least publicly, since the year 2000 when we first sort of regrouped Pluto with its icy brethren in the outer solar system. But it really hit ahead in 2006 when the official international community voted. And that's when people started taking official response, engaging in official responses to the mean community of astrophysicists. So three states issued legislation rebuking the international community of astronomers. And it's California, which is the home of the dog, Pluto. New Mexico.
But also a great planetarium.
Well, but many states have great planetariums, so that's not the only reason why. No, you read the legislation, Pluto the dog is all over it, worried that I think there's an explicit statement about Californians worrying about the stability of the physical constants if Pluto, what's something they grew up with, was no longer a planet. And New Mexico has legislation because that's where Clyde Tombaugh lived out his later years, and he still has family there, as well as a 96-year-old widow. And so did the state of Illinois take out legislation. That's the home state of Clyde Tombaugh. He's born and raised on a farm there. So there it is. You walk into those states, you start prancing around and reciting that Pluto's a planet, there's legislation saying that you're wrong. No, they can't do it officially, not scientifically, but it was quite entertaining nonetheless.
Well, we've had lawsuits about unscientific teaching in our schools in other areas.
Yeah, I don't know if this would ever lead to a lawsuit without it getting sort of laughed out of court. What people should really ask themselves is how much state resources got invested in creating this legislation in the first place.
Well, you advocate for a different way of teaching about the solar system. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, sure. Yeah, in the Pluto Files, it's mostly a retelling of this episode through the lens that I carried with me as director of the planetarium and as head of a committee that decided on what to do with Pluto. But I save my sort of pontificating for the very last chapter where I advise parents, teachers, science teachers and the public how they should think about the problem. I blame the fact that for decades we've taught the solar system as an enumeration of countable round objects with the number 9 associated with them. And so Mercury, Venus, Earth, there's a mnemonic to even remember them. My very educated mother just served us 9 pizzas. If that's how you learn something, any disruption to that sequence clearly will be a disruption to your, you'll have sort of existential angst if that memorized sequence is altered. So my feeling here is that the solar system should have then, and certainly now, have been taught as groupings of like objects. So you take the inner planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars. They're all small. They're all rocky. Group them together. That's the rocky planets. Then you have the asteroid belt. And then you have the gas giants. And then you have the icy Kuiper belt. And then you have this other group of comets called the Oort cloud. And when you do that, you get to compare and contrast what belongs in those categories, what doesn't. And you're not concerned about how many there are. I got calls saying, well, now that Pluto's officially not a planet, do you have to change the numbers of planets in the textbook? No, change how the textbook teaches from the beginning. Then you won't have that problem.
And actually, it's a much more interesting story.
I agree. And plus, it celebrates the richness and the diversity of phenomena and properties that actually exists in the solar system. Let me say that I would object to any classification scheme that has Jupiter and Pluto in the same bin, just as I would with Jupiter and Mercury in the same bin. These are two completely different objects physically, in terms of composition and all manner of properties. We need a more nuanced lexicon in order to have that conversation.
There's an asteroid that scientists have named Apophis that is scheduled to come really close to the Earth.
Really, really, really close.
How close?
Well, first, Earth plows through several hundred tons of asteroid debris a day. So what matters here is not simply how close, but how big it is for how close it's going to come. And Apophis is about the size of the Rose Bowl. The Rose Bowl were kind of an egg cup. It would sit neatly in the middle of it. And it's going to come on April 13th, which, by the way, happens to be a Friday, Friday the 13th in 2029.
And we know that for sure?
Oh, well, this is Newton's laws of gravity. Newton could have told you this 250 years ago.
Well, what about gravity? Is it big enough to actually affect Earth?
No. Earth is going to happily move. It's like a gnat flying around an elephant. Less than that. But something that size has never been seen to come as close as it will on that day. On that day, it will come closer than Earth's orbiting communication satellites, come within about 18,000 miles.
What determines the orbit of an asteroid?
A lot of things. There's first sort of its native orbit that it was sort of born with, and then it might get bumped by another asteroid. It might wander a little too close to some planets and not others. So their orbits are very hard to predict into the very long-term future.
If it's like a gnat with an elephant, why are there plans in the works to deflect it?
Oh, that's an important difference. If a gnat flies full speed ahead into an elephant, the elephant won't care. If this thing hits Earth...
Is it likely?
There's a chance it would hit Earth 7 years later, although it's a very small chance, several in a million is the latest chance estimated for that. We know it will not hit us on April 13th, 2029. So the risk, oh, by the way, so just so you know, depending on how close it comes to one planet or another, it will greatly affect its trajectory thereafter. And so it's like this multi-cushion pool shot. You know, the more cushions you have on your shot, the less certain you're going to be as to where the thing is going to land.
And has funding been put into place?
No, 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 unfortunately. And it's the right horizon of funding to a solution to saving the world. What kind of damage would this make? If it hit the Pacific Ocean, it would wipe clean the entire west coast of the United States because a 50-foot tsunami would roll in and just take away all of your million-dollar Malibu homes. It'll wash them out to sea, and then there'll be multiple tsunamis because the hole in the ocean would create multiple sort of splashes, and then the house would come sort of back to the shore in a slightly different shape than it was when it...
Well, this is a real concern. I may not be around in 2029, but an awful lot of people who are alive today will. They'll have known what happens when with Pluto, because by that time the probe will have passed Pluto, and then they'll have this thing to contend with.
Yeah.
On top of global warming and all the other problems.
Yeah, I mean, the Pluto, you know, our life is not at stake by the Pluto mission, so that's just sort of fun science as we glean it. But yeah, the rest of this, we have the power to actually deflect these things. I don't want to be... No, we're not going to go extinct from Apophis. By the way, named for the Egyptian god of death and darkness after its orbit was discovered to intersect Earth.
And Pluto, by the way, was the god of wealth as well as the dead. So that's where we get plutocracy.
Thank you. Thanks.
You've contested the accusation by many scientists that... that the Bush administration was waging a so-called war on science.
I'm quoted once on a YouTube about that, and people are trying to make a big deal of it. It's just very simple. When people accuse the Bush administration of waging war on science, that's a very powerful, strong language to use. And when you ask, well, what kind of war was it? And they'll mention global warming and...
James Hansen.
Stem cells, and maybe... what else? There's one or two
rejection
other
of appointments to the Department of Health and Human Services.
Well, so
based on voting records.
So when you do this, what you find is that would surely be related to the stem cell politics. So when you do, you find out that the war on science, if we call it that, was localized to those issues that were hotbed topics among the electorate of George Bush, the strong Christian right that helped get him into office in the first place. There's this whole rest of the body of science conducted in the United States. There's particle physics. There was NASA. NASA's budget went up under George Bush. It went down by 25% under President Clinton, for example. So it's, if you're going to write a book titled The Republican War on Science or Bush's War on Science, you should tune the title to be more specific about what it is he was fighting, and then that will tell you why. And it's because it was not a general war on science. It was a war on the subjects that served his electorate. And so the war was really not with Bush. It was about your 60 million countrymen who helped put him into office. And so I always wanted to make sure people understood what it was they were fighting out there. There are issues in the schools, issues among states, and these people vote. So this is the fight. That's the frontier.
Well, during President Obama's primary campaign, his senior domestic policy advisor, Melody Barnes, told NPR that Senator Obama believes that we have to double scientific research funding so that we can take advantage of the enormous talent in the United States and we can regain our global competitive edge. I haven't heard much about that recently.
Yeah, there was important early promises. You know, where the country's basically broke, so one needs to be quite clever or innovative in how you're going to get that funding back into place, especially since the kind of funding that speech referenced is the kind of funding that would pay dividends not in the next quarter, not in the next half, as corporate quarterly reports require of investments, but 5 years, 10 years, longer than a re-election timescale. And so that's why it takes truly visionary politicians to get that kind of thing into motion.
The Virgin Group has plans to launch Virgin Galactic, a commercial rocket trip into suborbital space by the year 2012. Do you think there's a future commercial space travel?
Well, suborbital space is just a really high, high shot into the atmosphere.
We've already had some people going up with Russian rockets, including Martha Stewart's boyfriend.
Oh, so now those were orbital flights. Those were high-paid seats onto the space station launched by a Russian.
So this would be lower than that.
Yeah, so this sort of commercial enterprise is they launch you up above the atmosphere. You look out, you see the night sky in broad daylight, and then you sort of fall back to Earth. That's got to be cool. I'd certainly sign up for that. But what we normally think of as space exploration, space travel, is as a minimum in orbit around the Earth. And you've got to go sideways 18,000 miles an hour, and that's a very different engineering problem than just going up in a high arc.
A space shuttle is set to be retired in 5 years. Will the American Museum of Natural History try to get one for their collection?
We're not a hardware-based institution, at least not our space.
Yeah, you do have the big whale and some of the dinosaurs.
Well, yeah, so they're artifacts of nature, but we don't expect or hope to compete with the Air and Space Museum, which is filled with those kinds of artifacts.
Neil deGrasse Tyson's latest book is The Pluto Files, now available as a paperback from Norton. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thanks for having me on.
On tomorrow's show, we'll examine how a new generation of billionaires like Bill Gates and Warren Buffett are reshaping philanthropy by applying business style strategies and models. Then director Robert O'Hara and actors Brian Tyree Henry and Andre Holland on the new trilogy, the brother-sister plays, which is running at the Public Theater. Also learn about the life of Patricia Highsmith, whose novels include Strangers on a Train and The Talented Mr. Ripley, plus the gurus of how-to, Al and Larry Ubell, feel your home repair questions. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Andrea Maraskin and Sarah Mazel. Debbie Fanta was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.